Beach easy.
He hit the crown of my helmet and my fourth vertebrae, it exploded on impact. And so I blacked out for a second. I'm on my back. I can't feel anything. My body is in complete shock. So I'm 17 years old. You know, think I got the world in front of me wide open. I can do anything I want with it, to lying on my back in shock. I can't feel anything. I'm terrified. Almost instantly, there were probably about 8 people standing around me, coaches. I could see them touching me and grabbing me, and I couldn't feel anything. And I remember my head coach, he looks at me, he goes, "We hope it's a stinger."
Welcome to Life's a Beach and Then You Die. From personal growth and self-discovery to challenges and victories, we discuss it all. Join us as we dive into the extraordinary stories of ordinary people all the way to the end.
Welcome to Life's a Beach and Then You Die. I'm Julie Ellis, and this week I'm joined by Ernie Johnson, an impressive young man who grew up in Conway, South Carolina.
My dad, to put it simply, is the most amazing man I've ever met in my entire life. And it's always ironic when I say that first, because my dad was an alcoholic. And the lessons that I learned as a child from the most amazing man I've ever been around and the biggest asshole I've ever been around, and the same man in the same house, taught me so much as a human being that I'll be eternally grateful for. For the first probably 12 years of my life, my dad was the highest functioning level of alcoholism you can imagine. He owned a business, drove an 18-wheeler. We didn't even know that my dad was making good money because he was so grounded and knew how important morals and values were, and respect and communicating and just teaching us to be adults and teaching us, preparing us how to live life on our own. He did that as well as any parent, if not better than every parent I've ever been around in my life.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing.
It is.
But you mentioned your dad was an alcoholic, was highly, highly functioning. Did you feel any sense of angst when he drank? Was he ever cruel or mean or rude or say terrible things? Like, what was that like when he did get drunk?
When he did get drunk, we put everything he taught us into action. We had each other's backs. It's okay. He's drunk. He'll go to sleep in a little while. That's not true. You know, he didn't mean that. And so that forced us to just embrace each other every time he got drunk. So yes, there was angst. There was nervousness. There was, oh my gosh, here we go again. But right in the middle of that, it taught us, even when it's a time of here we go again, I got you. We're going to figure this out. We'll get through this together. So now, not only do I have that attitude with my family, anybody that's in my circle, any friend, any associate, anybody that I share any kind of connection with, I have that connection with them. If you're on my team, we'll figure this out. Mm-hmm. There's always a way. We're going to be okay. Take a step back. Let's talk about it. Let's think about it. And we'll figure it out.
How often did Dad get drunk and upset the family?
So for the first 12 years of my life, it was just on the weekends. Mm-hmm. When I say high functioning, Monday morning, he would get up at 3 or 4 o'clock. He would go to work. And I remember, so he was driving an 18-wheeler. He used to drive to Gresham, kind of out off of 378. And he would get up, go to work Monday through Friday. Friday night, he'd get home about 7 o'clock, and he would be drunk from 8 on Friday night until 4 o'clock on Monday morning.
Oh, wow.
Clockwork. He was in such control that I knew it was something he was doing just because he enjoyed it. He just enjoyed it.
Yeah.
He was verbally abusive sometimes.
When he's drinking.
When he's drinking. And it was, you know, they say when people get drunk, they say what they really feel. Mm-hmm. That's not always the case.
I agree.
They also say whatever they can to get under your skin, to get a rise out of you. And my dad was a pro at that. I was, I don't know, 15. He would talk about my girlfriend, my first real girlfriend. I was in love. My brother, 2 of his sons are biracial. He would talk about his sons being biracial. My sister had green eyes. He'd call her a green-eyed devil. Like, he would just say whatever he could to get us to react to him, because he was bored. He didn't mean any of that stuff.
Yeah.
He was just saying it because he was bored. But it was every weekend, and he was never physically violent, but he would threaten. Yeah. There was one Sunday, we played spades. I started playing spades when I was like 9 years old because they would come over every Sunday and play spades. Well, he got drunk one Sunday. And when he got drunk, every time he'd get drunk, he'd tell my uncle to get out. Well, one Sunday, my uncle said, Frank, you know what? I'm not leaving. You call me over here every Sunday. You drink my liquor and you send me home. I'm not leaving. My dad said, okay. He walked down the hall. He got a shotgun. He walked back out. And my uncle ran out of the front door. He said, Frank, you really going to shoot me? He cocked it and shot at his feet.
No kidding.
I'm not joking. And my uncle ran home. But that was the extent of the fit. He never touched any of us out of frustration being drunk. Me, brothers, sisters. He was never physically. He did take a swipe at my mom once.
I was going to ask how he treated your mom.
When he was sober, my mom was the most amazing person on the planet. Everyone better bow down and respect my mom when he was sober. He treated my mom like a queen when she was sober. When he was drunk, he wasn't mean. He just wasn't that guy anymore.
Right.
He wasn't. He just wasn't that guy. Well, when it got bad, when it got really bad, when it took over, when it was no longer functioning alcoholism, when it took over his life, he tried to get violence with my mom one time. But my mom ain't soft, and she ain't no punk. And I don't know if she took boxing lessons or not, but she bobbed and weaved and caught him.
She clocked him.
And no, yeah, she did. And he fell and he hit the coffee table. And it's one of the funniest stories. He called his mom and told his mom that my mom was being abusive. And she called the cops on my mom. My grandma did.
Oh, my gosh.
And my dad ended up getting handcuffed that night. And that was probably the most, quote unquote, exciting thing that ever happened with all of the alcoholism growing up.
Did you witness that?
I did.
Yeah. How'd you feel at the time?
I was scared.
Yeah.
I was upset. And you know, it's funny you asked me that. In that moment, I think I must have been probably about 11 or 12 at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I'm just not going to let him treat my mom like this anymore.
And he held true to that promise. When Ernie was old enough and big enough, he confronted his father.
After my accident, I told him if he didn't go to rehab, I was going to move my mom out of that house. And so he goes, well, I don't want you to leave, so I'll go to rehab. His first day there, the counselor said, you don't have a problem. And he goes, well, I'm here for my family to prove it to them that I don't. 30 days, no detox, no problems. He just had a 30-day vacation. The day he got home, he bought a six-pack. And that proved to me he was choosing the alcohol over the love of his family. And that's when I bought the house that I'm living in now.
Yeah.
That same summer.
Did you move your mom out?
I did.
Yeah.
Ernie's childhood was complicated, but he doesn't hold resentment. His perspective on his father is unusually understanding and loving.
I would not change one detail of my childhood. It was the most amazing from 7 or 8 until my accident. Let's count that as my childhood. I would not change anything.
Yeah.
I love my brothers and sisters. I love my friends. I love the community I grew up in, my teachers. I have been surrounded by love and support my entire life. I am so grateful looking back at how many blessings I had in my life growing up that I wasn't aware enough of how much I should have appreciated them at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And appreciating it now makes living life now better for me because now I'm taking nothing for granted. Appreciating and looking back on how much I had as a kid.
Yeah.
Even counting the alcoholism. And not only that, the lessons that I learned from when he was drunk that shaped me into the man that I am today. Because like I said before, I saw what to do as a husband, as a father, as a man, as a brother, as a friend. I saw the heights of what it takes to be a great all of that. And the moment he got drunk, I saw exactly how not to do all of that in a nonviolent way, even though it was somewhat emotionally abusive.
Mm-hmm.
My brothers and sisters and I have all been blessed with resiliency. And so we were just born that way. But him teaching us those values and us sticking together and learning how to be resilient as a unit is carrying us now in our adult life far more than any of us could have considered. And I have to credit the vast majority of that to my dad.
It's amazing that not only did he teach you those values, he gave you instances where you had to apply them to get through by the same man.
It's like, he gave us the answers to the tests and gave us the perfect tests to question us to see if we were paying attention. And we did.
That is so interesting.
It's the most amazing. And when you say, was he drinking by choice or was it a weekend thing? In some twisted way, and I know it wasn't intentional, and I'm not trying to cover for him. I'm not trying to discount anything. It was shit dealing with a lot of the things that we dealt with when he was drunk. It was shit. I'm not trying to trivialize it. I cried. It hurt. My brothers cried. It hurt them. He took shots at us that a dad should never take at their kids. He made it personal, not to hurt us. He made it personal because he was bored when he was drunk.
Yeah.
He wasn't trying to hurt us as humans. He was just trying to get a rise of us while he was drunk. But it did hurt us as humans. But the love and the bond and the connection that I built with my brothers and sisters, not one of us resent anything my dad did to us.
That's interesting.
Both of my brothers and both of my sisters, maybe not my youngest sister as much of the rest of us, because she got the version of the alcoholism that wasn't functional.
Right.
She got the, I'm drunk every day, dad.
Is your dad still alive?
He passed away. It must have been, it was either 2003 or 2004. So either 18 or 19 years.
Yeah. How did he
cirrhosis.
Die?
Cirrhosis of the liver. Him.
And how old was he?
He was 53.
Wow.
And I tell this story because I tell people, not only do I know your life can change in a split second because of my disability, we were going to visit my grandma at hospice, all of my brothers and sisters, and we were all saying our goodbyes. When we left her room, we got a phone call. Your dad passed away. So we left the funeral home, drove to my house. He passed away on his bed the day after his birthday. And that's one of the only regrets that I still have in life now is I didn't call my dad on his birthday because I was mad at him.
Do you believe that a spirit goes on after it leaves the body?
I do.
So do you believe you've had a chance then, or that your dad knows you regret that and that you can still tell him what you wanted to tell him?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's kind of a nice feeling, isn't it?
I don't want us to get too deep into that in that part of spirituality, but I know my dad's proud of me.
Yeah.
I'm not one of those people that I look for that validation from my mom or dad because they never put that pressure on us ever. It's never y'all gonna have to take care of us when you get. It was never that.
Yeah.
It was always you always be the best you can be. But after my accident and after I moved out, one of the last things I remember my dad saying to anybody was saying to my brother Leon and my mom, make sure you take care of that boy.
Aww.
And for him to see me taking care of myself, to see that the values that he taught me, the morals that he instilled, has allowed me to create a life for myself as a quadriplegic and be happy and functioning and not needing anything from anyone, all because of what he taught me, he'd be proud of me. I know he would. And I'm doing it the right way with the right intentions.
Mm-hmm.
My dad wasn't a perfect man and neither am I. I mean, nobody's perfect, but he did try hard for his family.
Mm-hmm.
And I try hard for the people that I love.
Ernie's father taught him many lessons on resilience, respect, and the importance of family. All of those lessons came into play when Ernie had a horrible accident.
Ernie, you've mentioned several times now the accident, the disability. So now we go back to 1997. You were 17 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Really great athlete and playing high school football for Conway.
Yes, ma'am.
Tell me about the day that changed your life.
My oldest memory of that day, I remember the bus ride on our way to Monk's Corner. We were playing against Berkeley High School. And I remember just leaning my head on the window, trying to get focus, thinking about the goals that I had for myself, thinking about the potential of playing at the next level, and just trying to get in the zone And you hear athletes talk all the time, like the ones who are elite, their focus is just unmatched. And I was just getting ready. I knew I was going to have a big year. We had a really good team. And, you know, we had a shot at winning the state title. And I was getting ready. And it was on a kickoff return. Again, you know, I was one of the better athletes on the team. And so I was one of the deep guys. I was back with my friend Marquise Huggins, and he's still local too.
I know him.
You know Marquise?
Yeah.
He was a junior that year. He was the other deep guy beside me, and it was a squib kick. So instead of the ball coming, you know, in the air straight to us and, you know, taking 4 or 5 seconds, he kicked it low. So it bounced and it rolled and it bounced. And instead of it taking 5 seconds, it took about 8 seconds to get back to us. So the defense is 3 seconds closer to us. And so as I went to pick it up, and Marquise picked it up just before I did, the defender was probably as close to me as you are. And I was on my way up and couldn't get in the right position to hit him. Now, even though I was only 155 pounds, contact was one of my favorite parts of the sport. I was a pretty good hitter for my weight. And I saw the kid and I wanted to hit him, and I wasn't at the right angle. And he hit the crown of my helmet, and my fourth vertebrae, it exploded on impact. And so I blacked out for a second. I'm on my back. I can't feel anything. My body is in complete shock. So I'm 17 years old. You know, think I got the world in front of me, wide open. I can do anything I want with it. To lying on my back in shock, I can't feel anything. I'm terrified. So I'm laying there and I'm just waving my arms in the air, trying to figure out what's going on. Why can't I feel my arms? And it's almost instantly, there were probably about 8 people standing around me, coaches. And I remember them. I could see them touching me and grabbing me, and I couldn't feel anything. And I remember my head coach, Chuck Jordan. He looks at me, he goes, "We hope it's a stinger." What 17-year-old football player knows what a stinger is? I had no clue, but he was just trying to reassure me and comfort me. And then from there, they picked me up on the stretcher and took me to the ambulance. And I remember, again, being afraid in the ambulance ride to the hospital. My EMT person, she had an accent. I don't remember where she was from, but she was holding my hand. And I just remember, she goes, "I need to let you go for just a second, because I have to grab something." The back of an ambulance is what, 6x8? I had a meltdown. "Please don't let me go. I can't do this. Please don't leave me." And she said, "Young man, I'm right here. I just gotta let you go for a second." Blacked out again. And then I woke up on the hospital bed. They were cutting my clothes off. I guess they were getting me ready to go to get an MRI or a CAT scan. And on the way to get the exam done, I remember calling for my mom. "Do you have any sons?"
"I have one son."
"How was your son?"
26.
26. When he was a kid, what was the first thing he wanted when he got hurt?
"Mom."
"It's mom. I want my mom. Please, somebody grab my mom." And I hear a voice saying, "I'm right here, baby." She was holding my hand. Like, that's how much in shock I was at the time. And then from there, I woke up in ICU. I was trached, so I couldn't talk. And I remember seeing a few of my coaches. I remember seeing Stacey Bainham. And I remember seeing my nephew Ahmad. I think he just turned 30. And at the time, he was 5 or somewhere around there. And, you know, they don't usually let kids under 12 in the ICU. And he pitched a fit. He showed out. "You gonna let me see?" And they let him in.
Wow.
And then from there, I remember waking up on the 5th floor at MUSC. And that was a gift in disguise right there, but playing in Berkeley County. MUSC at the time was one of the best spinal cord hospitals on the East Coast. And I was just 30 minutes away from them.
Oh, wow.
So getting into surgery that soon after that accident is probably why I have as much function as I do now. I was at the perfect angle. The guy was at the perfect speed. That disc in my spine, it literally exploded. So instead of it breaking in half and cutting my spinal cord, it exploded and just kind of chipped around the exterior of my spinal cord.
Oh, wow.
So I have more function than I would have had otherwise. So when I woke up, the first face I saw was my brother Frankie. He was in California at the time. And I'm not sure if he was still a fireman or if he was in the police academy. I think he was still a fireman. But anyway, you think, I'm 17 years old. My big brother is, you know, my idol. Every chance a little brother gets to see his older brother, they're excited. So when I woke up And his face was the first face I saw. I forgot where I was. I forgot why I was there. And I get this shot of adrenaline because I'm just excited to see my brother. I was like, oh, shit, Frank, what's up? And then after I saw him, I looked around the room and there were about 12 faces and they all looked just like yours right now. They didn't know what to expect. They didn't know what was coming next. They didn't know what to think. Is he going to be okay? What can we do for him? And again, because of my dad and my brothers and sisters and how I was raised, I said to them, y'all are supposed to be here to lift my spirits. Y'all are here to hear to make me feel better about the situation. Y'all sitting there with long faces and sad eyes isn't helping me at all. I said, I need y'all. I said, I don't know either. But can we stop with the sadness and get to work? And at that moment, the sad face, just like you just did, the sad face went away. They smiled and we got to work. And, wow. And I've been me ever since.
How many days after the accident was that day when you woke up and your brother was there?
I don't remember the specific amount of days. So my accident was
like a month or a week.
No. It was days. So my accident was August 21st of 97. So that had to be within the first 5 days.
Yeah.
Because I was in the hospital from August 21st to October 3rd. So not quite a month and a half, but.
But you are the one who wakes up in a hospital bed and says, come on, y'all got to rally. Like, we got to do this. Yeah.
And I take it back to what I said earlier. We figured out. I'm a Johnson.
Yeah.
We figured out. We always do.
Did you go then after that through a period of mourning? I mean, you must have had some grieving.
All right. So on the way out of the hospital, the doctor at the time told my mom, we don't think you're ready to discharge. We don't think you can take care of your son. My mom said respectfully, kiss my ass. I've been taking care of him his whole life. I'll figure it out now. Again, we figure it out. And so we left the hospital, got home, and there was a night that I was up bawling, crying in the middle of the night. And there was a Bible sitting beside me. And I opened up my Bible and I flipped it over to, and again, at the time, I wasn't reading my Bible. I was a Christian because you're supposed to be a Christian. You grow up in the South, you go to church, you're a Christian, right? Mm-hmm. So I had a Bible. I opened it up to the book of Ephesians chapter 3. I want to say it was verse 13 and 14. And it essentially says, don't worry about your transgressions and your hardships. I put you here for a reason. When I'm done with that reason, I'll take you out. And I stopped crying. I said, okay. And I've been good since then. Don't get me wrong. I get sad. I get emotional. I still get frustrated sometimes. There was a time about a year ago where I coach high school basketball and I work a full-time job. It's a lot. And I'm by myself at home. So I'm getting up at 5 some mornings to get ready for work, to get to work early so I can get to basketball practice early. So I'm getting up at 5. And there was one night, it was 10:30 at night. And I realized I had only gotten out of my chair while I was at the gym to work out. And I was doing laundry. And I was tired. I was just tired. And I just started crying. I sat there and I cried for a few minutes. Guess what I said after my few minutes were? After about 5 minutes, guess what I said? You're Johnson.
You're Johnson.
Suck it up.
Yeah.
And you figure it out.
Yeah.
So from the time my accident happened till this day, I'm eternally grateful for the city of Conway. They have had my back emotionally, physically, economically. My community has had my, I am eternally grateful for Conway, South Carolina.
Did they in the high school rally around you?
They did.
Do fundraising to help you adapt a home so you could live
they
there?
They raised, I don't remember the exact number, but when I got the plaque for the Ernie Johnson Day recognition, that was the fundraiser. That was them letting us know how much money we had raised. I want to say they raised close to like 15 grand or something that to go towards my medical bills. And support isn't even a strong enough word. Every day after school, because I was homeschooled for the first semester after I got back home, there wasn't one day after school that somebody didn't come visit me.
Oh, wow.
Kids that I didn't even know. When I was in the hospital, I got cards, handwritten cards from elementary school kids, middle school kids. And that's the one thing that's hard for me when I'm sharing my story with someone else who has a disability. And they say, well, what was the hardest part for you? So many of them don't get support. And I had an endless amount of support. And I can't say thank you enough to every single person that has been there for me at any part of this journey, because it's helped make me who I am. It's helped build me up. It's helped give me the confidence that I have to make it through this life every day, because it's not easy. I see people with disabilities, and specifically spinal cord injuries, who don't have support, who don't have somebody to come over to their house and change their lights for them when their lights go out, right? I have brothers, right? I'm doing great for myself, you know, coming from the position that I'm in, but I have great people around me that help. I'm not a fool. I'm not. I have amazing people in my life, and I'm grateful for every single one of them.
That's amazing.
That's everything. It is. It's amazing. And I try not to trivialize it and make light of it. It is amazing, the support that I have in my life. I'm grateful. I'm blessed. I'm spoiled, whatever you want to call it. People say often to me, public, you're such an inspiration. The only thing more cliche to say to someone in a wheelchair than you're such an inspiration is, slow down, you're going to get a speeding ticket. We've heard these.
You hear that a lot.
Daily.
Oh my gosh.
Daily. I'm not going to go too far off topic. So when people would say to me after all of those years of, you're such an inspiration, you're such an inspiration, I'm like, you don't know me. Why am I inspiring you? Because you see me taking my wheelchair apart at the grocery store, right? Didn't you go buy groceries too? Like, oh my gosh, you are so inspiring. Why? Because I got hungry? Like, what are we talking about? Should I go and tell them I'm so inspired by them because they're at the grocery store too? I said to you yesterday, every single person alive is going through something. People think they see my struggle because they see the wheelchair. This isn't a challenge to me. I'm good at this now. This is not hard for me. From outside perspective, I get it looks hard. It looks uncomfortable sometimes. I've spent more of my life in the wheelchair than I did on my feet. This is all I know. I'm not embarrassed by any of it. I know how it all looks. I see it on camera. It doesn't feel to me the way it looks on camera. And I don't care.
Right.
Because it's all I got. It's all I know. Mm-hmm. Being embarrassed by it, not doing things in a certain situation because I don't want somebody to watch me, or if I have a muscle spasm and my foot comes off the foot plate when I just bought some food from the food truck, I used to be embarrassed. Oh, let me get that as quick as I can because I don't want people to see me have a muscle. I don't care now.
Right, exactly.
Right, they do feel bad for me, but that's not helping it at all.
Yeah.
And me being embarrassed by it isn't changing the fact that I'm having a muscle spasm and I gotta get, I don't care. I don't care what anyone thinks about the good, the bad, or the hardships in my life, because thinking about what other people think about it doesn't change any of it. It's just me spending time thinking about something that doesn't matter. But I wasn't fully your Ernie Johnson until about 7 years into it. And when that came back, energy is a real thing. People feel energy most of the time now. My presence is felt in most rooms that I'm in. Mm-hmm. Whether I try or not, I love me and I'm happy. And most people don't love themselves and most people aren't happy. And subconsciously, people want to be around that. And I think now, it's not that I'm doing anything special. I'm just happy. People want to be around people who are happy.
People respond to that.
And that's what it is. Yeah. And that's what it is. And I'm just aware of it.
Yeah.
Ernie Johnson shows us the importance of digging deeper. It would be easy to look at him and see only his wheelchair, but he's more than his disability. He's a person with life experience, with perspective. He's resilient and a powerful reminder that your attitude can change your life, no matter what happens in it.
If you've been inspired by this story or any others, please take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review.
We don't just get away at the beach, we get together. Because no matter what floats your boat, we're floating right along with you. With over 2,000 restaurants, live music all day and night, and endless attractions, Myrtle Beach was made for having fun and beaching easy. Welcome to 60 miles where you belong, the beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Plan your trip at visitmyrtlebeach.com.